Welcome to Vital Voices. Today we're talking about a new book, a biography of the late Chet Atkins, who was originally from the community of Luttrell, Tennessee. The book is entitled Chet Atkins, Mr. Guitar, and its author is Don Cusick, a historian of country music and the Kerb Professor of Music Industry History at Belmont University. We spoke with Don Cusick on Music Row in Nashville. Tell me where we are and some of the major things that took place in this studio.
We are in Columbia Studio A on Music Row. This is where Bob Dylan cut all or part of five albums. In here, Johnny Cash, Roger Miller, Tammy Wynette, George Jones, Marty Robbins, a whole list of folks. And right through the wall and downstairs a little bit is the Quonset Hut. And that was put here in 1955. And so early on, this is the first building that was on what became known or become known as Music Row. And so here we are, the birthplace of Music Row is right here. Oh, and Bradley bought a house, which is where my office is, where we just were. That was his office. And then he bought an old house, took out the middle floor. So he had the basement, basically, and the ceiling floor. I mean, the top floor. And that was his first studio. And then the Quonset Hut becomes popular. And Brenda Lee and Loretta Lynn and, again, just a who's who of country music is recorded there. And it's still running today, and students have classes in here, and they can learn how to operate the equipment. It's not the same equipment as there was in 1955 and 56, but, this is the place.
What is it like for you to come to work every day surrounded by this history and this music?
I'm in hog heaven. It's such an honor. And, every now and then I fall into sort of taking it for granted, and I have to kick myself because, people would crawl across cut glass for this. My office is where Stand By Your Man was written.
Is that right?
Tammy Wynette, yeah. It was written really by Billy Sherrill. It was Billy Sherrill's office, and he produced George Jones and Tammy Wynette and Johnny Paycheck and a bunch of those folks.
What is your career path? How did you land this job?
Well, I came to town and got a job in journalism, working for Record World. Well, I got a job with a CMA. I had worked for Record World for free. They call it internships now. But I worked for free because I knew the guy who was the editor or the Nashville editor of – it's a trade magazine. And I have a degree in journalism. So he said he needed some help. Well, after they did this big special every year on country music, and I had to go interview all of these people and write up the stories. After that, I got a job at the CMA as staff writer, and then I went back full-time to Record World. And from there, I went to Monument Records as an artist what's called artist development, sort of an in-house management group. And from there, I formed my own company with Dan Beck, the guy that originally helped me. We had a management and PR company. And then I'm really a writer, and I had not been writing. And so I went back to MTSU and got a master's in English. And they needed somebody with what we called a RIM program, this music business program. And I was there, and they said, why don't you teach down here? And I said, how about as an adjunct, just kind of part-time? I said, no, we need full-time. And so I became full-time then, and that got me in the academic world. Stayed down there for 12 years and then moved up here to Belmont, where I've been since 1994. And things just rolled from there. I don't know how to explain it. It's been a winding road.
And congratulations on the publication of your latest book, a biography of Chet Atkins.
Thank you. And He is an East Tennessee fellow and really was one of the major figures in the history of Nashville and Music Row and the recording industry here.
Let's go back to his childhood. I want to talk about hardship. Working against him, both in Luttrell and when his family moved to Georgia, were three things: poverty, a broken home, and asthma. How did he overcome those things?
Well, the asthma was the toughest because he was about, you know, his mother thought he was going to die. And it was a broken home. His father left and the kids were small. He stayed home and they lived in poverty. It was a single mom taking care of the family. She remarried later. But that was dirt, you know, that East Tennessee dirt's pretty rocky.
Yes.
Hard to grow a crop on that. He moves to be with his father in Georgia to just recover from asthma. The big difference here is that when he's in East Tennessee, everybody plays. It's a musical area. I mean, everybody's picking and grinning. That was your weekend entertainment. He goes to Georgia and nobody's playing. You know, he's the one that's playing and he has to develop a sound that he doesn't need somebody to accompany him with. And that's how the Chet Atkins finger style picking comes about. He works on that. He hears at night the ionosphere contracts and AM radio waves can bounce off of that. And so you can pick up a lot of stations. You know, when you're growing up, you came of age when you listened to AM radio at night and you could pick up, he picked up Cincinnati and heard Merle Travis.
Right.
He said if he'd heard him more often, he would have copied just what Merle was doing.
Yeah.
But they only really heard him once, I think.
And he varied that style.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't exactly copy Merle Travis, but that sort of gave him an idea, didn't it?
The difference is Merle Travis style, the thumb hits generally the tonic. The in the key of C, it would be the C note, or CG, it would be a 1 and 5, dun, 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 dun. And then you played with, Travis played with one finger, the melody. What Chet did was instead of doing 1-5, we'll do the open strings on the guitar. He would do A, D, E, D, A, D, E, D. And he did it quickly, so the thumb is kind of like a circle. And then he's picking with three fingers. And so it's derivative of what they call the thumb picking style. The finger style comes out of that, but it's quite different.
As well known internationally as he was for guitar playing, didn't he acquire his first job by playing the fiddle?
Yeah, of course, in East Tennessee, you played the fiddle as well as the guitar. So his father played the fiddle. In World War II, well, Pearl Harbor happened, and his father needed to go back to Cincinnati. And they, of course, he was working something to do with train engines. And he told Chet, you got to go back home. You got to go back to East Tennessee. Chet didn't want to do that. He didn't want to drop out of school. Chet loved school, loved to read. So Chet goes back to East Tennessee, to Luttrell, and decides to go down to the Knoxville radio station, WNOX, and says, you fellas need a guitar player or you need an instrumentalist. He took the fiddle. He didn't take the guitar. His guitar was an old Silvertone, which comes out of Sears and Roebuck. Played the fiddle, and they says, you got a job. So he's touring with Archie Campbell and Jumpin' Bill Carlisle.
Yeah.
And so he's playing with them as a fiddler. And one night, of course, there are, you know, six people in a car, and he has a guitar and somebody else's guitar, and he starts playing. And one of them asked him, said, where do you do that? Where'd you learn that? And, how many songs do you know? And they said, well, you'll be our guitar player because you're a terrible fiddler. He actually was a pretty good fiddler. But anyway, so that's how he got to be playing the guitar. And he ends up, of course, the key, the coveted job was staff musician at a radio station because you backed up everybody. by backing up everybody, he had to learn a new song every day. And he did it. And that's the foundation that led him to other radio stations.
I want to talk about his connection to the Carter family, which mm-hmm. was vitally important to his career, and mm-hmm. he acknowledged that throughout his life. How did that connection get established, and how did he work with the Carter family? What jobs did he have and where?
Chet was at WNOX. The Carter family came to WNOX. That's where he got to know them. Then they moved to Springfield, Missouri, and he moved to Springfield, Missouri, too. And somewhere along the line, Ezra Carter, who was Maybelle's husband, said, the girls and I have been talking, and we'd like for you to join the group. And Maybelle really wanted a top-quality group. I mean, they were into good quality music. So you got the Carter family stuff. You got the girls doing sort of pop-oriented stuff. Chet comes in, can back them up with anything. Does the guitar sound, that finger picking, and they hit on the road. And they split it six ways. It was very fair for Chet because, you know, he was low man on the totem pole. They get an offer from Martha White Flower to come to be on the Grand Ole Opry. Martha White had some problems. Well, they were selling Flower down in Springfield, Missouri, and they were selling a ton of it. And they said, well, Martha White could use that. And the feller who was doing the Martha White advertisements, he liked to nip a little. he tended to drink a little too much, so they needed to replace him. And anyway, they wanted the Carter family, and they said, okay, but not Chet. And the Carter said, without Chet, there ain't no Carter family. And they haggled over that for a pretty good while. Finally, they let him in, let him come to Nashville and be part of that. But they didn't want another guitar player in Nashville. They were union people, and they were trying to protect the jobs of the other musicians. Fred Rose says, I'll hire you. So he comes really with Fred Rose.
You say in the book, Chet Atkins was born at the right time. Explain that quotation.
Well, the first commercially successful record, country record, was Fiddlin' John Carson in 1923. Chet was born in 1924. So here we have the Fiddlin' John record, which opens up the Southern market. So now they're aware of country music. And Chet is growing up at the same time. And so when it comes time for the barn dances, of course, in the midday merry-go-round in Knoxville, the Grand Ole Opry, and there were barn dances all over the country. He was there at the right time and the right place. Although he got fired a lot, but it was, and he certainly was in the right time and the right place with the Carter family when they moved to Nashville. That was actually the second time he moved to Nashville. First time was in 1946 with Red Foley. Interesting thing here, at the end of World War II, 1945, there was not a single recording studio or record company in Nashville. Castle Studio opened, and they had radio studios, but not an actual recording studio. And Jim Boulay started Bullet Records. And that's where Chet made his first recordings, right place at the right time. Now, they cut out his spot on the Opry. He had a featured spot. And he got upset and quit. And so then he goes off to the other radio stations and kept getting fired.
We talked about the influence of people like Merle Travis, but I also want to get you to tell me about how jazz guitarists influenced Chet Atkins, and specifically I'm thinking about Django Reinhardt.
Mm-hmm. Chet was playing in Knoxville, and they have a library. All radio stations have a library of all these different types of records and whatnot. And apparently one of the guys who was also a musician there said, you got to listen to Django Reinhardt. And that's where Chet first hears Django Reinhardt. And then he's realizing what a great jazz guitarist he is. And that started his interest. And he would play, he recorded a number of Django Reinhardt songs as the years progressed. But that led him into, you know, jazz is the musician's music. He was a country boy, and he could certainly play country guitar, but, you know, great musicians tend to migrate towards jazz when they're as they develop, and he certainly played a lot of jazz. Like I said, he was a country boy, but he played a lot of jazz.
And the farther you look into his career, the more you see those jazz influences.
He got pretty deep in jazz, especially in his later years after he left RCA. But you know, at the very end, he got tired of it. He lost his touch with it and goes back to being a country guitar player.
Explain to me how Chet Atkins, the artist, becomes such a major part of RCA and its corporate culture here in Nashville.
A guy named Steve Scholes is the head of, well, they would call it race and hillbilly music way back when. It was country and blues. And so he's coming to Nashville because a lot of their talent is on the Grand Ole Opry to record artists. And he's hiring Chet as a guitar player. And he sees that Chet is good at organizing sessions and can find a song now and then. So he increasingly gives him more responsibility till he becomes, rather than just a session guitar player, an employee of RCA. He can still do sessions, but he's Steve Scholes' man in Nashville. And as time goes on, well, then Elvis hits. And when Elvis hits, Steve Scholes' time is taken up with Elvis, because Elvis is so big. And so that moves Chet into more executive positions. And so he becomes the head of RCA's country division. There was two sides to that. By being in charge of RCA, he could record whatever he wanted to record. He didn't have to run this by Steve Scholes or anybody else. He just, if he wanted to do a classical piece or a jazz piece, he could do it. The other thing, he was shy, he was reserved. He wasn't comfortable going out meeting people, but by being at RCA, he's a magnet. People are coming to him, and he rose to the occasion.
Don Cusick, thank you so much for joining us for Vital Voices.
Fred, thank you. It was great to be here.
The book is Chet Atkins, Mr. Guitar, written by our guest Don Cusick and published by the University of Georgia Press. For Vital Voices, I'm Fred Sossman.